Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, so glad that you can join us here for some classic cardboard conversation. And we've got some classic cardboard this time around. And it's a set that, amazingly, we've only talked about once. Yes, kind of keeping up with that theme of sets that we had talked about the first time, often for almost 5 years ago now. And we did the show, said how great the set was, and just kind of moved on. And we've recently covered a couple of sets from the mid-1980s, 87 Donruss and 85 Topps, that fit that bill. And I would have to venture to say that this week's set, which was also selected through a listener poll on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, is arguably the most popular of the four sets that we are taking a second look at. And that would be 89 Donruss. And if you look at the video that we posted on our new Wax Ecstatic YouTube channel, and it went up on Thursday, and we flipped through three packs of beautiful 89 Donruss, you once again fall in love with this set. And I really wish, when was it? 15 or so years ago. I really wish I bought more of those 89 Donruss boxes that were selling at only, like $12 a box at the time. Obviously before the whole baseball card market heated up again, because this is one of those sets, even though I'm very much involved in trying to hand collate a lot of late 70s and early 80s top sets, this is one of those sets I wouldn't mind building. Now, I'm not going to, because again, I've got a lot of focus and money going into these other sets, but we will discuss why this is a great investment of your time and not a whole lot of money, even though with marked up prices. As 89 Donruss has some incredible rookies, as we saw in the video, Craig Biggio, albeit with a wax stain on the back, Edgar Martinez as well. Those were just the rookies. You've got some great stars in there too. And of course, some legendary stars near the end of their career, Mike Schmidt being one of them. And we found some gems just in three packs, and I can only imagine what you can find if you pick up a few of these. And they are still affordable. And as we will discuss too, unlike some other mid to late 80s or junk wax era sets that are being ridiculously overpriced because there's one key big dollar rookie card where if you get a gem mint PSA 10, you can set down a couple months of rent checks with it. I'm talking like a 92 or a 93 tops Derek Jeter, something along those lines. We've got some pretty good cards here, pretty good prices, and really only one card that collectors go out of their way for, but it's still not enough to really hamper your tracking down of packs if you prefer to go that way or picking up the set. And you can still buy a factory set if you prefer that, and you can get those relatively cheap. So like a lot of the sets that we have talked about on this program recently, still available, still affordable, and just an outstanding set in terms of design and star power. And for many of us, it fell right in the middle of our collecting glory days. We were all in our early to late teens, sucked into, the hobby. And before things got all fat and bloated with all the sets and premium sets and refractors and parallels and all that nonsense a few years later, there was still a little bit of innocence in 89 Donruss. Although it would be from the last year of any kind of innocence, as the Pandora's box of junk wax was opened fully in 1989. We will discuss that as well as a look at three players in the bottom of the order, three random polls from the packs that we opened up. And boy, we've got some really fun stories here. We've got one of the great rated rookie busts of the 1990s. However, he has redeemed himself with an outstanding post-playing career as a coach, a free agent coach now, I still believe. But Hensley Bam Bam Mullins is one of the players we're looking at. We'll also look at one of my favorite players. Speaking of a great coach, he was one of the first coaches for the Tampa Bay Devil Rays and would actually be the last remaining coach from the original 1998 team. And he also had some dramatic moments as a player, in particular the 1986 NLCS with Houston, 1990 World Series with Cincinnati, talking about Billy Hatcher. And then a guy that just sometimes gets overlooked, although he should not be. He had some glory days in Boston and for various reasons was off the radar in stops elsewhere around the American League and finally in the National League, talking about Freddie Lynn. Yes, the first player to earn Rookie of the Year and MVP honors in the same season. That was a feat that was not accomplished again until 26 years later when Ichiro did it with Seattle. But we'll look back at Freddie Lynn, some regrets that he may have or perhaps may not have, and the what-ifs around a couple of his interesting transactions, transactions that happened and didn't happen. So we will discuss that later on in the program. Now, before I talk about what's upcoming on the show here, I do have some pretty exciting news to share. You may, if you have headphones on and you're really paying attention to the sound quality, you may notice that it's not quite as crisp. And it sounds like it's perhaps being recorded in a Howard Johnson hotel room in Scottsdale, Arizona. Well, that's because it is, actually. I announced on my personal social media channels, it was about a week ago, a little over a week ago, a week and a half ago, that I am closing in on a new work opportunity in Scottsdale, Arizona. That's where the company is located, a company called Skyview Networks, but basically the Phoenix, Arizona region. And I'm not only, as I'm recording this podcast, visiting the fine folks here at Skyview in Scottsdale, but doing a little house hunting, getting to know the area a little bit, as the family's going to be moving out here. In fact, about a month from now, we'll be packing what's left of our house, plus my wife, two kids, and two cats for what should be a Griswold-like adventure across Interstate 10 from Florida to Phoenix, Arizona, and searching out all the pet-friendly hotels along the way. So certainly great news there. I don't know if you're aware, but I have not been working full-time in almost 2 years now, believe it or not. I had my position cut with the Tampa Bay Lightning almost 2 years ago. Started up my own business, did some contract work, still do some contract work and advising and consulting. And COVID comes around, of course, puts the brakes on everything. But as things have settled down and as business is getting back to normal in many ways, it is also an opportunity. And a lot of people are doing this too. It's an opportunity to do something big and bold and exciting and a little different and just, you know, turning the page and checking out life in Arizona is definitely something big and bold and different, but it is exciting. My family is excited at the opportunity. I've only been here for a few hours as of me talking, and I absolutely love the area. And it is true what they say. It's a dry heat. It is very dry and it is very heaty. I believe it is 106 degrees right now. I'm not making that number up. That was actually the number on the thermometer in my car. And living in Florida, you know, those thermometer numbers, they're kind of misleading because of where the thermometer is placed on the car and humidity and direct sunlight. You know, your car's thermometer may say 98 degrees, but it's really like 94. But no, here in Phoenix, if it's 106, it is 106. But for those of you who have never experienced a dry heat, if you have a hairdryer in your house, just plug that bad boy in, turn it on, low or high, totally your choice, and just kind of from a distance point it at you, and keep it there for as long as you can. That is a day in June in Phoenix, Arizona. That's the best way I can put it. The other method would be to stick your head in your oven, but I would not advise that. That is generally bad for your health. But other than being able to pick up some full-time opportunities with Skyview and a job role that is being defined as we speak, very excited to move out here and kind of start a new adventure. The podcast will continue. We're going to keep doing this because it's a lot of fun. I know the listeners have chimed in again, working on the Wax and Gum Stains website as well. But, I just want to give you a heads up because there may be, because of the move, there may be a week where we skip the podcast and we go basically 4 weeks between podcasts. And that's just simply because as much as I want to keep it going and keep the regularity, unless I record a bunch in advance, and I could do that, but unless I record a bunch in advance, there's a possibility that we're going to miss one. And it's not because we don't want to do it. It's just simply logistics. Again, I've got to go back and forth between Tampa and Phoenix over the next few weeks, a couple times, and bring my family about a month from now out there. And it's a hands-full situation. So hang tight with me on that. Now, speaking of summer projects, that's why I've been alluding to this. This is something that didn't just happen. It's been working up over the last 2 or 3 months. But waxandgumstains.com, it's still going to happen. We're still going to do it. And I've been alluding to how it's a process that's going to take a little while. One is because, as I've mentioned before, I do want to get it right for you. But two, I've got to work it around all of this. So bear with me. It is still a work in progress on that to-do list. Now, the next program is scheduled to come out 2 weeks from today. That would be Friday, June the 18th, as we will take a look at the final set that was selected by our listeners as one of their favorites that we talked about once and then just kind of moved on from. That would be another Donruss product. This is amazing. Three of the four sets, Donruss sets, except it was an extension of the Donruss product line. That would be Donruss Triple Play. We're going to look at the 1992 set. I think that is the most influential because what Donruss was trying to do with Triple Play, that is gearing a card towards the younger end of the Generation X scale, trying to rope in, I'd say, kids between the ages of 8 and 13. We'll talk about why they were trying to do that in 1992. But I think they met that goal then. The problem is, for various reasons, it wasn't extremely well accepted. And Triple Play eventually just kind of morphed into, still a kid-centric baseball card, but it also kind of fell back on some of the defaults of baseball cards. The specialness of 1992 Triple Play very slowly oozed out over subsequent sets. So we'll look back at a set that I really enjoy collecting then, and I'm eagerly awaiting a few packs that I've purchased to arrive at my doorstep back in Florida when I get back home, as we look back at 1992 Donruss Triple Play. Now, one other thing that I do want to tell you about before we talk about 89 Donruss is I do have some extra packs and even a handful of extra cards that we will package together and basically put up for sale on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. And we did this a couple months ago. I had some extra when we were looking at 92, 93, and 94 Donruss. I had some extra packs and we packaged them together and basically just put them up for like 20 or 25 bucks, shipping included. And we had somebody claim them. So up for grabs will be, I've got two packs of 89 Donruss. I've got two packs of 93 Flair, and I've got, I'm going to have a jumbo pack of Donruss Triple Play left. I got a lot with two. I'm only going to open up one for the show, so we'll save one for this junk wax, itch scratching package here. But we're also going to throw in, I don't know how many yet, because I've been so busy locking down this job and planning trips to Arizona. I don't know exactly how many cards, but have you ever walked into a card shop or a card show and you found a box of cards from a set you're trying to complete, but you don't have that list of cards in front of you? So you just start pulling cards that you think you need, and then you get back home, you're like, oh, damn, I've already got this one and this one and this one. Well, that recently happened. There's a card shop that I went to a few weeks ago, and I went rummaging through the bargain bin, finding some, let's just say, not PSA 10, but still very good condition, generally speaking, cards from 1975 through 1982, in many cases. Not a ton. I bought, I think, like 30 cards. But I just have that hunch that probably 5 or 6 of them I already have. So once I go home and cross-check what I got from the shop with what I already have on hand, then what I will do is take those cards I got from the shop and the price that I paid for them, and again, they're bargain bin because they're not PSA 10, because I got them at a pretty good price, I'll basically factor in that price in the total price of the package that we send out. So be on the lookout for that. Probably next week I'll send out a tweet with some pictures of the cards and the packs, and we'll set a base price, and whoever wants it first can have it, and all proceeds from that sale of these excess packs and cards will go right back into the program so we can buy some more stuff to talk about in future shows. As always, suggestions of topics are welcome. You can email me at waxandgumstains@gmail.com, or if you prefer, just send us a comment on the Wax and Gumstains Twitter feed. Again, at Wax and Gumstains, just send us a note, and I will be very happy to look through all suggestions. And, sometimes I find some things on my own that even interest me. Well, I just do a little eBay cruising, and I've been doing this recently, and there's a few sets that I've forgotten about, or there's a few sets that I just didn't even bother collecting that we may dive into a little bit, because the show started with sets that I had in my possession, and we've expanded it a little bit, and we'll have some pretty fun conversations about some of those other sets. Now let's talk about a really fun set, 1989 Donruss. One of the absolute gems in the history of Donruss baseball cards. You could argue that 89 Donruss is the best set that Donruss put out back in the day. Now, I've said the same thing about 87 Donruss. That is a top-notch set. And you could also look back, obviously, at the 92, 93, 94 sets where Donruss really raised the bar and put out a premium base set, even though base sets were dying on the vine because all the attention was being put on the separate premium sets and all those other subsets that came of them. But 89 Donruss has everything you could ask for. A great design, and in fact, a very unique design. When you look at the 89 Donruss card, you look at the front, and up top, kind of like almost like a TV graphic up top, you've got the player name in this rainbow gradient. And I'll talk about the gradient in just a little bit. But it goes from one color on the left, and it kind of shifts into a second color on the right. Two primary colors in many cases. For example, the Craig Biggio rookie card starts with red on the left, yellow on the right. So, of course, you have orange in the middle. Now, that same matching gradient is located at the very bottom of the card, a thinner stripe. In between, most of the space is dedicated to, in many cases, an action shot, sometimes a stage shot. But either way, a player picture. On the side borders is this light gray with dark gray line background. And then you've got a full color team logo in the upper right corner. And one other thing, you've got the Donruss 89 logo in the lower right corner, or lower left corner, I should say. And all of these various colorful elements come together, even though it's not what you would see years later, where 100% of the front of the card was just given to a photograph, and typically an action photograph. Even though you have a lot of working pieces here, it still works all together. And the colors flow, the action shots flow. You see the player's name, the position, the team logo. It looks nice. But what really flows, quite literally, is that rainbow gradient. And I pointed this out in the video that we posted on the YouTube channel. If you take cards, and often this was sequentially in order in the pack, if you take one card and you take the next card in the pack and you line them up side by side, normally the gradient continues. So with the Biggio card, you had red with a little bit of orange in the middle and then yellow. Well, the next card would have yellow trending into green, and you had kind of this light green in the middle. And then, you know, you had green, you know, on other cards, green going into blue, blue going into purple, purple going back into red. And this rainbow cycle would just continue. And it's a really neat thing if you just lay some of these 89 Donruss cards side by side, even if it's not sequentially, but if you just put them side by side according to the color of the rainbow, you get this just really neat visual effect when you put four or five or six of these cards next to each other. And I thought, what a really neat, almost subliminal design element of the 89 Donruss cards here. You know, it's one thing to just splash some color on there, and it's another to use what was then a very technologically advanced, you know, blending of colors and having this gradient going from one to the next, and especially with two primary colors on the edge, having that blended color in the middle. But to have it continue through the next card, and the card after that, 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 was really, really, really cool. And I just thought it was a stroke of artistic genius by the Donruss folks to do this. And I don't think it was accident. I think it was fully intended to be this way. And, you know, I think that's something that Donruss was trying to do for many years. And I'll go back as far back as 1985, where you had the black background, the black borders with the red stripes. Well, obviously, if you lay a bunch of them next to each other, you have this continuous pattern. Same thing in 1986 with that diagonal, almost like a scrambled television signal pattern in the background. Same thing with 87, where you had the black borders, but you had the little cluster of baseballs and the gray strip in the middle. And then even the much hated 88 Donruss, if you look at the Olin Mills photography design that they had with the blue and red and black squares, if you lay several of these cards together, like you make a big square out of the cards, all these little squares come up behind it, and it almost looks like a science experiment. So I don't think it's accident that 89 Donruss did this, because when you go back several years, this was a very common theme. And it is something, too, that will continue in 1990 and 1991 with some very horrific designs, how you could lay one card next to the other and they would almost link up to each other. But perhaps that's another reason why we enjoy 89 Donruss so much, is that we remember the horror of 1990 and the goofiness of 1991 Donruss sets, where 89 just looks like an absolute piece of art. But then again, it really is in so many ways. So the front of the cards are great. You flip them over, the back of the card, much like 87 Donruss, again, relatively the same design since 1982, essentially the same design since 1985, just a changing of the colors. And in 1989, Donruss went with a deep, dark goldenrod color, which reminds me of the triplicate forms that we used to have to fill out, or our parents used to have to fill out back in elementary school. Now, a few weeks ago when we talked about 89 Donruss, our good friend Nick Deonte mentioned that Domruss cards were something special. There was a specialness to them. And I commented back, and he mentioned this comment on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. I said, I have a special story too, and this is perfect for 89 Domruss, because for me, I remember the specialness of Domruss cards then, because this was when I was really starting out in the hobby in 1989. Now, most of you know my story, how, you know, mom takes me shopping one day. We find a bushel basket full of 89 Topps cards. She says, do you want some baseball cards? I say, yep. And that's what got me started. And that was what I exclusively bought in the first few months, was 89 Topps cards. And why did I exclusively buy them? Well, because that's pretty much all I knew. Oh, here are the baseball cards. They're in blue wrappers. They're, you know, 45 cents a piece, according to the MSRP, or in the case of that public supermarket that day, three for a dollar. And, you know, that's all I knew. So whenever I was in a grocery store, that's what I bought first. Well, in my neighborhood, and I grew up in a small suburb of Tampa called Sefner, what we would call a bedroom community. Nowadays, we'd probably call it a low-income drug haven. But back in the 80s, bedroom community. So we'll go with that. And in the neighborhood I grew up in 1980s suburban Tampa, we didn't have a public supermarket on every street corner like pretty much Tampa Bay does now. And, you know, we didn't have a drugstore on every corner. I mean, it doesn't take much of a stretch of the imagination. You probably live somewhere where this is the issue, where you have a Walgreens on one corner and a CVS on the other, quite literally across the street from each other. We didn't have that back then. We didn't have strip malls and shopping malls all over the place yet. No, in my neighborhood, we still had orange groves. They were dying, but we still had orange groves. We had a few small subdivisions popping up, but that was about it. It was still very, not just suburban, but dare I say almost rural. And it's not like we were out in the country. It's just you had to go for a little bit of a drive if you wanted to go to the grocery store or, you know, the baseball card shop or whatever. Well, in my neighborhood, we had, in a nearby intersection, a convenience store. And not just any convenience store. One of the gems of the 1970s and 1980s, the Magic Market. Now, raise your hand if you remember the Magic Market. It was a Munford store. That's what it said. That was the name of the company that owned Magic Market. Now, Magic Market is still around today, but it is much smaller. I think they're mostly in Georgia. There's like 15 or so stores. And I was looking online. Their stores are really no different than a racetrack, gas station. And, you know, gas stations and convenience stores are such a higher level now. There's Wawa, there's Thornton's, there's Bucky's. Like I said, there's Racetrack, you know, Radiant. They're all the same. They're big, well-lit. You walk in and there's aisles and aisles of food. There's freezers and freezers of drinks. And like a racetrack in my neighborhood, I walk in and there's an ice cream bar. You know, there's 40 different types of donuts. There's 20 different types of coffee. And you almost have to pinch yourself. You're like, wait a minute, wait. That's a gas station. What the hell is this? It is convenient and quite tasty, though. But that's now. But you go back to 1989-ish, and even before 1989, like I said, I grew up in this neighborhood throughout the 80s. We had the Magic Market, and the Magic Market was not big. It was not, you know, loaded with gas pumps like these racetrack, you know, stations. You've got like 24 gas pumps. In fact, there were no gas pumps there. And you didn't have aisle after aisle after aisle of snacks and chips and donuts and coffee and freezer upon food. No, this was your 1980s suburbia convenience store. Not Circle K, not even 7-Eleven. Magic Market was kind of the the bratty young brother of Circle K and 7-Eleven back then. And I remember, like, I could close my eyes and I could still see the Magic Market. I can still smell it. There was a weird, unique smell of the Magic Market. But you would walk in. It was a relatively small, might have been like 1,000 square feet of space. You had maybe three aisles. I don't know what was on all of the aisles. I just know where the candy aisle was. That was the aisle that mattered most to me. That's where I got my bubble tape. That's where I got my everlasting gobstoppers and all the other crap. I do remember a few other elements of the store. I remember the freezers where the soda was. That is where I was exposed to knee-high blue cream ale. Knee-high blue cream soda, which was a kind of vanilla-ish flavor of blue soda that really just looks like windshield wiper fluid. But it was so good. And the slush puppy machine. That's right. We didn't have Slurpees. We didn't have Icy's. We had Slush Puppy, the bastard child of frozen drinks in convenience stores. And most importantly to any child growing up in the 1980s suburbia of America, in the corner was the one video game. There was always one arcade game there. And I remember management hanging up a sign and chasing people out because the middle school and high school kids tended to congregate around that video arcade machine, and that of course scared some of the locals. So I remember it well, and one reason why I remember it well, it was within walking distance of my home. It was like maybe a 20-minute walk. It was also back in the time where mom and dad weren't too afraid of let the boys walk over to the Magic Market and back. And in my limited allowance money that I had back then, like I said, I could buy a slush puppy or, some candy or something like that. And a dollar would get you a lot there. So imagine my surprise in the late fall of 1989. I hop on my bike and I ride on over to the Magic Market. And I walk in. And I bypass the slush puppy machine. I bypass the freezers of strangely flavored sodas. I'm not even paying attention to the video game in the back. I'm going down the arcade or the candy aisle. And what do I see? I see a box of baseball cards. But wait a minute. These aren't the ones that I bought. These aren't the ones in the blue wrappers. What are they? Don Russ. Who is Don Russ? And why is he making baseball cards? And these packs were cello packs. And I remember, I think they were 99 cents, maybe 89 cents. But anyways, I remember picking one up. And I didn't buy any candy. I didn't buy any soda. I just bought that jumbo pack of 89 Don Russ baseball cards. And I remember taking them home and opening them up and looking at them and being amazed by them and the color. And the one card, and I think I've shared this before on the program, the one card that from that pack that I still remember to this day, just because of the color gradient at the top, it was a stage shot. But I remember the look on the guy's face. I remember his haloed California Angels hat, Dante Bichette. That was one of the cards that was in the pack. And there was just something about this Dante Bichette card. Like, he just had this look in his eye like he was going to murder the baseball. And, of course, Bichette often did back in the day. And I just remembered there was just something really, really cool about this particular brand of baseball cards. Now, this being a Magic Market, they didn't exactly have a large stockpile of these items. And the baseball cards didn't fly off the shelves as quickly as the lemon heads or the Boston baked beans, which were quite possibly one of the most disgusting candies at the time. So, you know, I was only able to procure two or three other packs as time went on. And like I said, it was late fall, so I think they were just getting rid of the 1989 stock. But I saw how special these cards were, And this kind of opened the door to me as a young new collector to something other than Topps. And of course, 1989 opens the door for a lot of people because you not only have Topps and Donruss and Fleer in the second year of Score, but now Bowman comes in and Upper Deck comes in. So being introduced to Donruss, it was kind of like the gateway drug to all the other card sets that are out there. You ever tried to smoke a pack of 89 Donruss? Anyways, so candy cigarettes, I could get those at the store back then, but I didn't. 89 Donruss was a special treat. And even though Donruss had made some deep inroads into the hobby by 1989, and they were producing some outstanding sets by then, I still think at the retail level, Donruss and Fleer were still just kind of chipping at the iceberg, while Topps had dominated it. You know, Fleer I could find at my local Albertsons, but Donruss I had to find in the rinky-dink Magic Market of Sefner, Florida in 1989. I don't think the Magic Market... Well, Magic Market like shut down stores a few years later, and then it was called the Oasis Market for a long time. I have been in there. I don't think the business is even open anymore. I don't even know if the building is there anymore. But I remember about 5 or 6 years ago, I happened to be in my old neighborhood, and I drove past it. And I thought, well, what the hell? Let me go in here, because I remember the slush puppy machine and the colas and the candy and the arcade machine and the baseball cards. And I walked in, and boy, what a dirty, dingy, scary place that was. I think I just grabbed a bottle of Gatorade and then, you know, drove back home. But anywho, a lot of specialness for me for 89 Donruss. It's a special childhood memory. But like I said, it was kind of the gateway drug of all these other sets that came out at that time. Now, as for some particulars about the 89 Donruss set, 660 cards, including as part of the main set, the Perez Steel Gallery Donruss Diamond Kings. Those were the first 27 cards, 26 player portraits, and then 27th card was the checklist. You also had your usual bunch of rated rookies, some better than others. And you had a pretty good assortment of rookies, as I mentioned, Craig Biggio and Edgar Martinez before. The big card in the set, of course, Ken Griffey Jr. Donruss, one of the companies like Fleer and Bowman, and of course Upper Deck and Score, you know, scooping Topps here. Even though Bowman was part of Topps, I've always wondered, and I'm sure it was just to move some Topps traded sets, but Topps deciding to hang on to the Griffey Jr. rookie card until the traded set. But the Griffey Jr. rookie card, it is the one card of the entire set that actually has a pretty high value. If you were to get it graded in gem mint condition, it is worth a couple hundred dollars nowadays. That's not the main purpose of this program, but I do like to mention it because that is a factor in how cards are being priced these days. Well, since the Griffey card, which is still plentiful, is the only card that carries a hefty price tag if you go the grading route, and if you're lucky to get a Gem Mint 10 out of it, that means the other 659 cards are extremely affordable, including the Martinez and Biggio rookies and young star cards. John Smoltz, his Donruss rookie, is in there. You've got a young Tom Glavine, Randy Johnson as well. A lot of young stars from the 1980s. And as I mentioned before, some of the older veterans, including Mike Schmidt at the end of his career, Nolan Ryan as well, George Brett, Robin Yount, the usual group from the early to mid 70s that were starting to wind down their careers in the late 80s and early 1990s. Packs are still affordable. Yes, they've gone up just a little bit because of the baseball card buying frenzy these days. But if you look around, you can find some good deals, typically on lots of packs. And sometimes you'll find people that just have old broken boxes and they just have a lot of 20 cards that they want to get rid of. So you can find those at pretty affordable prices. Boxes are still somewhat affordable. Again, not quite the 10 or 12 bucks like I used to pay. You're going to pay a little more for them these days. But you can find them pretty easily. Card shows, card shops, eBay, you name it. And as I also mentioned, if you want to bypass that and just go out and buy a pretty set, you can still get Donner's factory sets dirt cheap, under $20, and you know that's with the rookie card for King Griffey Jr. in there. But some places, because these sets were printed en masse and they didn't unload them all back in 1989, they're happy to dump them to you now for the amazing low price of, you know, $10, $12, maybe $15, because they know that the only card that is of any value, any great value in there, is the Griffey card. And, you know, the other rookie cards are nice, but it's only one card that's kind of pulling a premium. And compared to some other premium cards, you know, like I said, a Derek Jeter rookie or a Chipper Jones rookie from future sets, it doesn't quite pull as much, so that keeps the overall price of the set down. That's good if you're a collector, though, because you can get that factory set cheap, or you can hand collate at a rather affordable price. So if you haven't looked at 89 Donruss in a while, please do it. I had a lot of fun opening up those three packs. And like I said, if I wasn't focused so much on trying to complete two or three more of these late 70s and early 80s top sets I'm working on, this would be a fun little project where, you know, I'd buy a box or maybe two of 89 Donruss and just see, you know, hell, I might be able to get two sets out of two boxes. But, you know, just to put it together and store it away, because it is a beauty of a set. It has an emotional attachment for me, as I described, and just loaded with rookies and stars. It just looks awesome. Still strong all these years later. And for a set mired in the early stages of the junk wax era, 89 Donruss holds itself up extremely well. There are a lot of sets from the late 80s and early to mid 90s where you look at them and you go, oh yeah, I remember that, and you just kind of toss it aside. 89 Donruss is not one of those. There is still energy, there's still a pop to it that a lot of junk wax era sets don't have. 89 Donruss definitely does. All right, now let's get to the bottom of the order. As we prepare to wrap up the show, we're going to take a look at the bottom three here. Not that they're bottom three players, but you catch the drift. We got three random selections from the packs that I have opened up and some interesting stories here, including Billy Hatcher. He was actually the first card that we pulled out of all of these packs here. And you want to talk about colors popping, not only the rainbow gradient on the top, but Billy is in a batting position, and he is wearing a Houston Astros uniform. And, you know, you got the rainbow shoulder stripes and the rainbow atop the cards. And it's quite the cornucopia of color. Now, as I am in Arizona, I'm not too far from where Billy Hatcher was born and raised. Williams, Arizona. It's a couple hours north of Phoenix. Born in 1960, starred as a pitcher at Williams High School. In fact, he once pitched an 11-inning no-hitter during his junior year in 1978. He graduated in 1979, went on to play for Yavapai Community College in Prescott, Arizona, and he was a junior college All-American. Now, the Chicago Cubs, sending out their scouts, of course, spring training in Arizona, so they get to hear about this youngster in Williams pretty quickly. So the Cubs decided to select him in the sixth round of the 1981 amateur draft. Now, an interesting little tidbit here, he would play exactly one season at each minor league level before getting his major league debut in September of 1984. Of course, a very magical season for the Cubs. Now, he would split some time between the Cubs and AAA in 1985 before being on the move. A rather bizarre trade here for the Cubs. I'm sure they were looking for some kind of veteran presence in the deal that they made in December of 1985, as they sent Billy along with Steve Engel to the Houston Astros for Jerry Mumphrey. Now, Mumphrey had a pretty decent career and was even an all-star for the Astros in 1984. But, you know, after the 1985 season, he was going on 36 years of age. Still managed to hit over 300 in a couple of seasons with the Cubs. But you have to wonder, you know, here's this youngster, and, you know, maybe there's a logjam in the outfield. I don't recall, but it's just odd that a team would take an up-and-coming young player who had started at the minor league level and had showed some promise at the major league level, certainly not greatness, but definitely some promise, and you trade the soon-to-be 25-year-old for the soon-to-be 33-year-old. That was very odd. But then again, that was the Chicago Cubs in the mid-1980s. So with that trade to Houston, Billy Hatcher finds himself in a pretty good position, specifically as the starting left fielder for the next 3.5 seasons. 1986, a breakout year for Hatcher, appearing in 127 games, batting .258, 6 home runs, 36 RBI. You know, nothing really crazy there, but comes the 1986 playoffs, the epic six-game series battle between the Astros and the Mets in the NLCS. Hatcher hit .280 in the series, but he is best remembered for hitting a 14th inning home run that kept the Astros' hopes alive in Game 6. Of course, the Mets would eventually go on to win that game in the wee hours of the morning and advance to the World Series against Boston. Now, in 1987, Hatcher had his best statistical season. In fact, he started it off with a bang, a 16-game hitting streak to start the season. He would finish the season with a .296 batting average, career high in stolen bases, home runs, and RBI. He also got suspended for back corking. And Hatcher later said that, that's not my bat. You know, that's always the excuse, isn't it? Remember Sammy Sosa when he had his back cork incident? And that was something Hatcher would have witnessed as a coach because Sosa was playing for the Cubs and they were playing the Devil Rays at the time. And, Sosa gets caught with a corked bat and he says, oh, that's not my regular bat. That's my batting practice bat because I like to hit home runs for the fans in batting practice. And, of course, most people kind of went, oh, yeah, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, yep. And, that was Hatcher's line when he got caught. He said that he borrowed the bat from relief pitcher Dave Smith. So it's the pitcher's fault. It's Dave Smith. Thank you very much. What's it like under that bus there? Dave Smith allegedly had the corked bats, and Billy Hatcher, just grabbed the wrong one after he broke several of his own bats. To this day, Hatcher says, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Now, at the end of the 1989 season, or I should say near the end of the 1989 season, the Astros, in full-blown sell-off mode at the time, totally going for the rebuild, send Hatcher to the Pittsburgh Pirates for Glenn Wilson. Now, he would play just 27 games for the Pirates in the remaining few weeks of the 89 season before getting sent to the Cincinnati Reds for Jeff Richardson and Mike Ressler. Now, this would work out very well for Hatcher, much like the trade to Houston. Hatcher had a pretty average season in 1990, stole 30 bases for the Reds, so pretty notable accomplished there. Let me see, what else did he do in 1990? Let's see, 139 games, .276 batting average, 5 home runs, 25 RBI. Good. Not great, but much like in 1986, Hatcher would save his heroics for the playoffs. First of all, in the 1990 NLCS, 4 games that he appeared in against his former team, the Pittsburgh Pirates, Hatcher would go 5-for-15 for .333 batting average, including a home run. And in the 4-game sweep, the surprising sweep of the powerhouse Oakland Athletics, Hatcher went 9-for-12. He hit .750. In that series, and that is despite leaving Game 4 of the series early after getting hit on the hand by pitcher Dave Stewart in the first inning. And he was actually taken to the hospital for precautionary x-rays, and they were negative, so he was able to rejoin the team later. But Hatcher, surprisingly, was not named Series Most Valuable Player. That honor went to Jose Rio, who, of course, peaked at the right time there as well. And just a phenomenal playoffs if you combine both series. Hatcher going with the .404 batting average in 14 games, including 2 home runs, 6 RBI, and 12 runs scored. Now, as the Reds started to decline in the middle of the 1992 season, he is traded to the Boston Red Sox for pitcher Tom Bolton, and he has the notoriety of having stolen home plate against Toronto's Juan Guzman. Guzman was not known for a speedy delivery to the plate. But Hatcher did manage to pull that feat off in 1992, starting center fielder for the Red Sox in 1993. And then his career would wind down in Philadelphia in 1994 and then with the Texas Rangers in 1995. Now, shortly after his playing career, he got right into coaching, and in fact, with the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, a minor league instructor in 1996, minor league coach for the Florida State League champion St. Petersburg Rays in 1997, and then, as I mentioned before, from 1998 through 2005, he was a man of many talents. First base coach for a couple seasons, bench coach, third base coach, and then back to first base as well. And he got moved around here and there, and he was named the first base coach for the Miami Marlins prior to the 2020 season. Now, the Hatcher family, the genes of athletics run pretty deep. He and his wife, Karen, have two kids, one, a boy, Derek, who was the Class A Player of the Year at Berkeley Prep in Tampa in the year 2004. He would later play football for the University of Richmond, a team that won the 2008 NCAA FCS National Championship. Their daughter, Chelsea, a star soccer player, played at the University of Tennessee from 2008 to 2011, an all-SEC first-team player in 2010. So there's Billy Hatcher, not just with the color and the multiple rainbows on his uniform and baseball card for the 1989 Donruss card there, but a colorful guy too. I remember him as a base coach with the Rays. He was a very fun guy to interview and didn't hold back too. It was very straightforward with a lot of his commentary as well. Not in an aggressive way or a rude way, just a guy who just told it like it was. Now, a man who was one of the best players in the mid to late 70s and would have a very solid career, but many parts of it overlooked for various reasons. Our next player, Fred Lynn, pictured on his 89 Donruss card with the Detroit Tigers. Of course, Freddie Lynn best remembered for his time with the Boston Red Sox. But did you know Fred Lynn was almost a member of the Yankees? How weird would that bizarro world be? Well, let's start from the beginning, shall we? Frederick Michael Lynn, born in Chicago in 1952. His family quickly moving to Los Angeles, in fact, partially because of a divorce. Things were a little turbulent in the Lynn household in the 1960s, but Lynn would continue to live with his father. And he would continue to excel at multiple sports, not just baseball, but also basketball, football, track and field. And according to the Society for American Baseball Research article written by Tom Nahigian, a marble player as well. Even though he grew up in Los Angeles, he was a Giants fan. And he actually liked the Giants because they were the hitting team. The Dodgers, of course, in the 1960s, best known for pitching and base running and dink and dunk and winning games 2-1. Well, you know, the Giants, you had Mays and McCovey, and he obviously modeled his game after those particular players. As I mentioned, he stood out in multiple sports, but especially with baseball. He won batting titles in Little League, Pony League, and at El Monte High School. And Lynn, much like Hatcher at this point in time, was a pitcher. Now, he was also an outfielder, but he was a pitcher whose material could be best described as good but not great. He had a lot of the tools, but did not quite have the direction to become a solid pitcher. So despite an 11-1 record and a 1.01 earned run average as a junior and a solid senior season as well as a pitcher, he kind of plateaued there. That was it. So he was going to be a guy with a solid arm out in the outfield. Now, he also started in football at the same time. He was a kicker and also a punt returner as well. And he decided to attend college at the University of Southern California. In fact, he actually got in at USC on a football scholarship. He was a teammate of another Lynn, That would be Lynn Swann. Yes, Pro Football Hall of Famer Lynn Swann, big star with the Pittsburgh Steelers. And, you know, Lynn Swann would be the wide receiver for USC. Meanwhile, you've got Freddie Lynn, you know, returning kicks and kicking the ball as well. Interesting that, you know, he was such a solid two-way player. With a future Hall of Famer. However, baseball was his true love, and during his sophomore season, he switched his scholarship over to baseball, and that was rather impeccable timing, as the Trojans, led by the legendary Rod Dedeaux, would start a championship run of epic proportions with USC in 1971, 1972, and 1973. Lynn was an All-American in 72, named MVP for the U.S. All-Stars during a series in Japan, and he was clearly going to be a star baseball player. But with whom? Well, I mentioned that he could have been a New York Yankee, and that is true. Fred Lynn was actually drafted by the New York Yankees in 1970, third-round draft selection, but he chose not to sign with them and went the USC route, and that was a very smart thing for him to do. So, come 1973, the Boston Red Sox, picking one spot ahead of the Los Angeles Dodgers. And in fact, because Lynn, you know, was obviously a big star with USC, he thought he would get drafted by the Dodgers in the first round. Well, that didn't happen. So in the second round, the Dodgers are looking at Lynn, but the Red Sox pick him off one pick ahead. He signs with them in July of 1973 and moves up their farm system rather quickly. And in fact, in 1973, he plays for their AA team in Bristol. The next year, he's playing in AAA in Pawtucket. And then he is very quickly making his debut with the Boston Red Sox. Now, at first, you're not thinking that, you know, this guy is going to be a bona fide star for the Boston Red Sox. So, you know, with a 15-game cup of coffee in 1974, although it was rather impressive, hitting .419 at that time, but it was 1975 where Fred Lynn would just absolutely take over, not just the Boston Red Sox, but the entire American League, and you could argue Major League Baseball, as teaming up with Jim Rice, who of course was in left field. Rice and Lynn were known as the Gold Dust Twins. Now, that was a brand name of a detergent, a washing soap, that on the original packaging, and this was from a Massachusetts or a New England-based company, the packaging featured two young black children. And in artwork that is very typical, showing young black children in the early 20th century. And, you know, it was kind of the typical caricature of them at the time. And in fact, there was a rather racially insensitive, you know, look to them in terms of a radio show that came around. And it was very 1930s. Going on here. But the whole reason why Lynn and Rice were called the Gold Dust Twins was because, you know, they worked in tandem, but also got very dirty, making some incredible plays out in the outfield at Fenway Park. Now, while Rice was pretty solid in 1975, he hit .309 with 22 home runs and 102 RBI. Lynn is stealing the thunder in center field, hitting .331, 47 doubles, 21 home runs, 103 runs scored, 105 RBI, and as I mentioned earlier, was the American League MVP and Rookie of the Year. He also won a Gold Glove as well and led the league in several offensive categories. And while he is best known for his bat, he should not be forgotten for his glove. He won four Gold Gloves, 1975, 78, 79, and 80. And of course, 1975 would be the start of a very long stretch of All-Star Game appearances. Fred Lynn would appear in nine consecutive All-Star Games, and he is still to this day the only player who has hit a grand slam in All-Star history. He has also tied Stan Musial's record for most All-Star home runs. He has four career All-Star home runs, which is pretty amazing. Now, what's also amazing is, despite this incredible time with the Boston Red Sox in the late 70s and going into 1980, the Red Sox were a little bit of a cheap operation at that time. Fred Lynn is an All-Star. Fred Lynn's hitting over 300. He's going to, you know, make a killing in his first free agent contract. Well, the Red Sox decide to not pay him what he's worth on the market. So in January 1981, they send him and pitcher Steve Renko to the California Angels for Joe Rudy, Frank Tanana, and Jim Dorsey. Now, Lynn, even though he was in his hometown and playing for a great owner in Gene Autry, had a little trouble adjusting to not being a Boston Red Sox. And in the strike-shortened season of 1981, he hits only 219 in his first year with the Angels. However, he's able to rebound with a solid 1982 season, appearing in 138 games and hitting 299 in 21 home runs and helping the Angels get their way back into the playoffs. Another heartbreaking Angel performance, though, leading the Milwaukee Brewers 2-0 in the ALCS and then pissing away that lead in the best-of-five series. The Brewers would go on to face the Cardinals in the World Series. 1983, Lynn's last All-Star season, 272, 22 home runs, and and that's despite some injuries, by the way. Heading into 1984, another banner year for the then 32-year-old, hitting 271. So he becomes a free agent, and he's looking to cash in. And who is ready to throw some money around? Well, it is none other than the Baltimore Orioles. And the Orioles, who had finished a few games under 500 in 1984, they're looking over at the American League West, where the Kansas City Royals, with a worst record, let me backtrack there. The Orioles finished a few games above 500, not below. They were a few games above 500. And they look over at the American League West. The Kansas City Royals win the division with a worse record than the Orioles. And the Orioles ownership and management just goes, you know what? We're closer to a championship than people think. So they just spent tons and tons and tons of money on free agents. Now, because of the free agency rules at the time, the compensation by picking off these top unrestricted free agents, the Orioles were giving up some of their top draft picks, specifically in the 1985 draft. And the Orioles would not have a draft selection until the 99th overall pick. That's in the fourth round of the 85 draft. Now, I don't necessarily like to look at draft picks that are, you know, in other sports traded, or in baseball's case, then given up because of free agency signings, and go, well, if they didn't give up that pick, they could have signed this player, you know, the player that the team that lost the free agent signed. But if you look at the 1985 draft, there are quite a few serviceable players, including some diamonds in the rough, such as some kid in Michigan. I think he was a 22nd round pick, a guy named John Smoltz, you know, who was drafted. And really the sacrificing of all of these draft choices for the chance at trying to just quick start a championship team really backfired for the Orioles, as an aging and veteran team, including Fred Lynn, injury prone, stumbling and bumbling and often finishing under 500. Well, not only did they lose more games than they won, they had nothing in the cupboard when it came time to replacing veteran players with prospects. And that's how the Orioles bottomed out in 1988, of course, starting off with that dreadful, 0-21 streak to start the season. The Orioles, this was a tremendous mistake. And unfortunately for Fred Lynn, he was involved in part of that. But hey, he was offered the big money that the Red Sox were never going to pay him. He was still kind of a fish out of water in California. So he goes back to the East Coast, to Baltimore, and his best season is his first season, where he appears in 124 games and hits 263. He would hit 287 the next year, but due to injuries, played fewer than 115 games throughout the remaining few seasons. Now, Lynn also did not win Orioles fans over, other than being an overpriced free agent veteran. He kind of mocked the team a little bit, made fun of the logo. Remember, they have the cartoon bird now, but in the 80s, it was the white front of the cap and the orange bill. And Fred Lynn called the Oriole the little duck. And that did not go over very well with some very passionate and frustrated Orioles fans. So August 31st, 1988, the O's trade him and a player to be named later, and Chris Hoyles, to the Detroit Tigers for career minor leaguers Robinson Garces and Cesar Mejia. So they basically just dump Fred Lynn, but also give up a good prospect, Chris Hoyles, to Detroit. Now, there was some controversy here because the trade happened on the last day of the non-waiver, or the waiver trade deadline, I should say. But Lynn, because of transportation issues, didn't report to Detroit until a couple days later. So the Tigers, who acquired Lynn for a last-second playoff push, there was some confusion on if Lynn would be eligible to play for the playoffs. Well, Commissioner Peter Ueberroth at the time decided that he would be eligible if the Tigers got in, because the deal was consummated on August 31st, and even though it was a day or two later before Lynn actually showed up in Detroit, he was still technically eligible for postseason play. In the end, it wouldn't matter, as the Red Sox would edge out the Tigers for the American League East title that year. 1989, a rather forgettable season for Fred Lynn for the most part in Detroit, other than, you know, not providing much to that playoff push for the Tigers in 88. In 1989, batting .241 in 117 games. Granted free agency after the 89 season, and in 1990, signing with the only National League team that he would ever play for, the San Diego Padres, where he batted .240 over 90 games. 17-year career, 1,969 games. He had, let's see, how many hits? 1,960 hits, .283 batting average, 306 home runs, over 1,000 RBI. As I mentioned, MVP Rookie of the Year and Gold Glove Award winner in 1975, won three other Gold Gloves in the MVP running in 1979, nine consecutive All-Star appearances as well. When his playing days ended, he turned to broadcasting, and after broadcasting, became very much involved in the philanthropic side of things in Boston, where he has been very involved with Child Haven, and is also now part of the USC Hall of Fame and College Baseball Hall of Fame, and the Ted Williams Hitters Hall of Fame as well. Whew, it got all of those accolades in there. Pretty impressive there for one Freddie Lynn. Why did he not make it to the Hall of Fame? Good guess. 5.5% of the vote in 1996. He was crapping out in 1997 with only 4.7% of the vote. And one has to wonder, especially as more and more players of his caliber, you know, a career .283 hitter, almost 2,000 hits, over 300 home runs, if he's considered by the Veterans Committee. The offensive numbers alone won't do it, but I think when you look at the Gold Gloves, the All-Star appearances, and just that dominant 1975 season, you have to wonder if one day Freddie Lynn will get in the Hall. Now, one thing I am certain of is that Hensley Bam Bam Mullins will not be in the Hall of Fame. But if I had a Hall of Fame of cards that I had way too many of as a kid, and in particular, not the 89 Donruss rated rookie, but the 91 Donruss rated rookie, because I bought a couple boxes of those back then Hensley Mullins would definitely be in there. Hensley Philemon Ocasio Mullins, nicknamed Bam Bam because of his ability as a softball player, as a teenager, to crank out some left-handed home runs. He is a native of Caraco and played in professional baseball from 1989 to 2000. And even though he flamed out as a Yankee prospect in the early 1990s, he did make, albeit brief, still amazing comebacks in the major leagues in the late 1990s. Signed as an undrafted free agent in 1985, was able to work his way up through the Yankee farm system and earning some accolades, including being named the Carolina League All-Star, or being named to the Carolina League All-Star team, I should say, in 1987, and also being a star player, including being the International League MVP in 1990 with Columbus, starting to turn heads here, Hensley Mullins. He had a very, very brief cup of coffee with the New York Yankees in 1989. Let me pull up the exact stats here. Stand by. Didn't have those notes ready here. Come on, Sam, and get it together. It's got to be the time change. It's throwing me off here. All right, yes. 8 games in 1989, a 179 batting average. Even though he was starring in AAA, he was becoming one of those dreaded 4A players because in 1990, with 23 games of experience, batted only 241. Did manage to hit a few home runs, however. Had a little trouble hitting the curveball, though. 83 at-bats in 1990, 25 strikeouts, and that trend would continue. In 1991, as the then 24-year-old Mullins, not really cracking the Yankee lineup with consistency, 96 games played him, 288 at-bats, batting .222 with 97 strikeouts. And with the Yankee team that was definitely rebuilding in 1991, just could not land that permanent spot, often platooned out in the outfield with Mel Hall, and that pretty much did it for his Yankees time. As in November 1993, the Yankees actually sold his contract to the Chibolati Marines in the Nippon Professional Baseball League. So he would spend the 1994 season there, hitting 23 home runs, but still striking out with consistency. But in 1995, he played a part in helping the Yakult Swallows win the 1995 Japan Series Championship. Now he decides to come back over to America and has an unsuccessful tryout with the Atlanta Braves, but starts playing with the Montreal Expos and has a little time in their minor league system, where he is actually a pretty solid player for their AAA club, the Ottawa Lynx. So he gets a call up at the age of 30 to Montreal, and in 16 games is actually quite productive. .292 batting average, 2 home runs, 10 strikeouts. But, you know, he just doesn't really fit in with a still relatively young Montreal Expos team. So after the 1997 season, he signs with the expansion Arizona Diamondbacks in 1998, where he appears in just 7 games, hits a whopping .067, and his major league career would come to an end after that brief fling with Arizona. He was actually sent to the Chicago White Sox as part of a condition deal, but never really did anything with the White Sox, and was granted free agency in October of 98, and that was the end of his playing career in the major leagues. Now, however, he would strike it big internationally, representing the Netherlands in the 2000 Summer Olympics in Sydney, Australia. And that he would play a part in helping the Cuban team suffer its first Olympic loss in 21 games. Now, the Netherlands didn't perform extremely well in the 2000 Olympic Games. However, he did come back to coach the team for the 2004 Summer Olympics, as well as the 2009 World Baseball Classic and 2013 World Baseball Classic, and he is still part of that crew. Now, he would also continue coaching, first in the minor leagues, but then getting an opportunity with the San Francisco Giants in 2010 as, ironically, the hitting coach for the Giants, filling in for the previous hitting coach, Carney Lansford, who was let go in 2010. Well, he was part of the Giants winning a World Series in 3 of his first 5 years. He would then be interviewed by the Yankees for their vacant manager position, which was eventually given to Aaron Boone. Mullins would then become a bench coach for the New York Mets for the 2020 season, but then was fired after the 2020 season for reasons he has no idea, other than the Mets are, generally speaking, just a mess. Now, Mullins also runs the Dutch Antilles Baseball Academy, and supposedly, according to several programs, it wants to start a baseball league in Caraco in association with the Major League Baseball RBI program, which would be really cool if he is able to do this. You may not know this, even though Mullins is somebody who would strike out maybe five times a game, he is capable of speaking five languages: English, Spanish, Dutch, Papiamento, and Japanese. How cool is that? He doesn't speak rated rookie, though, even though his 89 and 91 Donruss cards do. All right, that's a look at the bottom of the order there. A fun look back at some interesting players from that time. Billy Hatcher, prime of his career. Freddie Lynn winding it down. And Hensley Mullins, perhaps going to be a prime player. Oops, wasn't the case, but certainly an impactful hitting coach for the Giants and all those World Series victories from not that long ago, and also doing some great things in Caraco and representing the Netherlands in international competition. Well, that'll do it for our look at 1989 Donruss. Again, a great set that is still very affordable. The Griffey card, you may have to chase a little bit, but if you don't want to go searching for packs and boxes and paying a slightly higher premium for those, as I mentioned, you can still find those cards in the factory sets at very reasonable prices at your local card shop or card shows, maybe even on eBay. If you're not too adventurous, that's one way to do it. And take a look at the design. Look at how the colors blend, how the colors connect one card to another. And take a look at the great photography, the great rookie class, the great stars, even the average players like a Dante Bichette looks menacing in his 89 Donruss card. It's an incredible set. And as I said before, you could argue that the 89 Donruss set is the best set that Donruss put out in the 80s. I still think 87 is the best set. You could argue 84, perhaps. But 89's up there. I think you've got a pretty good argument that that's the best set. And again, arguably the best set that Donruss ever put out. And the best part is because it's part of the junk wax era and because there's only one key card that investors and speculators will go for, it's easy for collectors to actually collect. And at 660 cards, a hell of a lot easier to do than a 792 card top set, or you know, some of the bigger card sets of the early 90s that were hitting 800 and 900 cards. So affordable, easy to find, well within your grasp of getting, and I highly recommend that if you haven't taken a second look, or if you have a few extra bucks and some time to put together that set, do so. 89 Donruss is a definite, and at the very least, for people my age or you know, plus or minus a few years, will very likely bring back some great childhood memories. If you have any questions, comments, thoughts, send them to us either via email at waxandgumstains@gmail.com or give us a post at waxandgumstains on Twitter. Again, our next scheduled podcast coming up Friday, June 18th, we'll look at another Donruss product, also colorful and innovative, 1992 Donruss Triple Play. And one of those Triple Play jumbo packs will be part of that junk wax itch scratching package that I'll put together, featuring not just the 92 Triple Play jumbo pack, but also a couple of 89 Donruss packs, a couple of 93 Flair packs, and a handful of those mid to late 70s cards that oops, I accidentally bought extras of. So be on the lookout for that. Again, probably about a week from now, we will have that out there. Continue to treat each other well. If you haven't gotten your COVID vaccine, please do so. It's free. It makes life a lot easier. I can't tell you how great it is to walk around without a mask and to know that the likelihood of getting sick is practically none. In fact, it's weird. I'm walking around with a mask and I don't know when to put it on or take it off anymore. It's a social thing now. But get that vaccine and get ready to experience a somewhat normal life once again this summer. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.